Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Snafu. Please visit our website and our Patreon page for bonus content such as pictures of the characters, maps of the airfield, Q&A episodes, and much, much more. This podcast contains explicit content that may not be suitable for some audience members. Listener's discretion is advised. The boss, Jack, Rosie, and Andy were all four lying on their beds, enjoying some sleep. Even though Coco's snoring was worse tonight than it had ever been in the past, the men were so tired from the previous day that they all passed out before Coco fell asleep. It had been 2 days since the men got back from the 24-hour pass, and they all returned hungover, and some returned back broke. The day before, the group stayed and drank in their huts, since England had been hammered with a nasty rainstorm. For people like Jack, drinking all day with men like O'Brien, Sheila, Coca, and Rosie, while hearing the sounds of rain hitting the metal roof, it was very relaxing for Jack, and he had no problem falling asleep when it was time. The boss had introduced Ronnie and Mickey to the men from Deuces and Texas's crews. Hill House and Texas both took a liking to Ronnie, and they had a night of fun at the officers' club, singing songs to Benson's guitar and Nebo's piano playing. The boss also invited men like Michael Shelby and his co-pilot to the mix, and they all got along well, although they all agreed that Shelby's co-pilot was a bit odd. The front door of their hut opened, and a new sergeant walked in. The man turned on his flashlight, looked down at his clipboard, and then pulled out a pack of cigarettes. He took one cigarette out and walked over to the boss, and after turning on his lamp, he nudged him awake and said, "Lieutenant Backus, you've been chosen to fly today's mission." At this, the boss sat up, and that's when the sergeant gave the boss a cigarette and proceeded to light it after the boss put it between his lips. As he lit the cigarette, he continued by saying, "It is now 0410, breakfast is at 0415, briefing is at 0500, and engine start at 0630. The sergeant then went over and did the same thing with Jack, Rosie, and Andy, handing out cigarettes like a priest handing out communion wafers. Brolin and the others weren't selected to fly today's mission, but they wished the men good luck and waved them off as they left the hut. At morning mess, the men of the Bull sat at different tables, with Jack and Rosie sitting with Parnell and his crew, along with Leslie and his crew. The boss and Andy sat with Ronnie, Mickey, Appleton, and Michael Shelby's crew. The two separate groups of men sat on different ends of the mess hall, showing that things still weren't fixed between the boss and Jack. The night of the Moxie, Shelby went and told the boss what Jack had said, and it resulted in the boss only feeling more hurt and more upset with Jack than before. At Parnell's table, Jack was enjoying a heated debate that Parnell was having with Leslie about whether or not Oklahoma is or isn't the asshole of America. Leslie, having been from Tulsa, Oklahoma, was getting very heated over his home state being made fun of, while Tim was purposely digging his heels in, trying to defend his point, just to get Leslie upset. This may have seemed cruel and mean to anyone else, but to men like Jack, Rosie, and Leslie, this type of thing created a lot of humorous, rant-filled arguments that helped to cut the tension that the men were feeling, and to some degree, Leslie knew this and allowed the rants to continue. The mess hall was full of airmen, showing signs that wherever they were going to go today, it was going to be a big mission. This was backed up when Eris made the observation that he saw men from all four squadrons eating. The last sign that today was going to be a big mission was due to the fact that the breakfast that morning was stripped steak, white gravy, fresh eggs, breakfast roll, and potatoes. Over the enlisted men's mess hall, Willie, Skimpy, Tommy, Mills, Beans, and Pally were sitting and eating their hearty breakfast, with the men from Deuces sitting behind them, making conversation. Men like Attila were so nervous for today's mission that he nearly puked when he took his first bite of his breakfast and gave the food to Willie, who gladly ate it. Skimpy was still shaken up from a few nights ago, and he hadn't seen Emma since they returned home the next day. Mills had spoken to Emma and relayed a message to Skimpy that said that Emma needed some time to recover from their frightening episode. Skimpy understood, but he felt like he was slipping mentally. In the middle of the group's breakfast, Skimpy looked up and saw a familiar face walking past her table. It was Rob Baber, the top turret gunner from Hellfire from above. "Rob?" Skimpy yelled out. Rob looked over at the men and walked up to their table and said hi, all while looking very somber. "Where the hell have you been? We haven't seen you or gotten a chance to talk to you since we came back from Berlin," Mills said to Rob.
I was sent away,
Rob said.
"Sent away? To one of those flak farm things?" Mills asked.
Rob nodded his head.
"Damn, are you okay now?" Mills asked.
Rob again stayed silent and nodded his head.
"What's it like at one of those?" Skimpy asked.
Rob didn't say anything. He just stared at Skimpy with a 1,000-yard stare and replied back, "Dr. Walker is helpful."
"Dr. Walker?" asked Tommy.
Rob nodded his head again and then said, "It's good to see you guys are still around. I'll see you up there, okay?" Mills watched as Rob walked away like a man on autopilot. He then looked over at the men and said to them, "I've got to find out what the hell is in those flak farms." Willie agreed. Skimpy listened to what the men thought flak farms consisted of and what was wrong with Rob. While he did, he looked down at Willie's gold watch that he gave him. And when he did, Skimpy saw that it was almost time for the men to go to their equipment huts and head to their briefings. He hoped that today was going to be an easy mission, with little to no enemy resistance. An hour later, the officers were sitting in the briefing hut and were waiting to find out where they were going to go today. Again, all signs pointed to the fact that today was going to be a very big mission. The 300th was going to be flying the low wing of the first group of bombers, and the 530th would be flying the low squadron of the low wing in the lead group. Captain Robert Dearborn would be leading the 530th in the low squadron in his plane, Chiefs, along with Lieutenant Parnell, who would be flying off of his right in the number 3 spot in Fenway Bombshell. On the opposite side of Chief in the number 2 spot would be the boss and the rest of the crew of Loaded Bull. Flying in the number 4 spot, which was between both Chief and Loaded Bull, was Lieutenant Leslie and his crew of Bomb McGee. Flying off Leslie's left in the number 5 spot was the rookie crew of Bombshell Blondie, flown by Lieutenant Michael Shelby. On the opposite side of Bomb McGee, in the number 6 spot, was Hellfire from Above, flown by Ronnie and Mickey. Today, the 530th Squadron had an additional plane flying the low squadron, a plane named Butch's Bitches, flown by a pilot from the 528th Squadron, who went by the common nickname Butch. As the men talked amongst themselves, Colonel Poole arrived and called the men to attention. Once he arrived on stage, he thanked the men for keeping up the good work and getting the job done. He then told the men that today's mission was going to be big and important, and he asked for everyone to stay focused and take detailed notes. Then, after his caveat, Colonel Poole signaled for the curtain to be opened. Once it was pulled back, the room roared with groans as Colonel Poole announced to the men that, quote, "The target for today, gentlemen, is the Frankfurt Industrial Center in Frankfurt, Germany." We'll be right back.
3 hours and 40 minutes later, March 29th, 1944, 22,000 feet above the English Channel, 0838. The boys of the 300th were heading to the Dutch coast, where they would pass over their second waypoint, 25,000 feet above Kemperland, Holland. The men had just test-fired their guns and watched as two B-17s from the 306 collide, which sent enough debris flying through the air that two more B-17s, one from the 306 and one from the 351st, had to abort and turn back to England. The escort fighters for the day were two squadrons of P-51D Mustangs with drop tanks. This was a big deal, for that meant that the escort fighters would be able to escort the bombers to and from the target that day, which they needed. The men on the base seemed more stressed out and upset with this mission than they had been with bombing Berlin. According to men like Leslie, who flew a bombing mission to Frankfurt back in January, Frankfurt itself wasn't as bad as Berlin, but the surrounding area of Frankfurt was worse than Berlin. In order to get to Frankfurt, the formation would have to zigzag through flak fields of Timburg, Maarschot, Bonn, Cologne, and Dusseldorf, to name a few cities. The men on board the Bull were tensed up and kept off the intercom. Skippy was sitting at his radio operator's desk looking over the flight plan that Andy had made for him, with estimated times that they would be arriving at specific points. The paper simply read, Waypoint 2, Coast, 0850. Waypoint 3, 0910. Decision Point, 10:05. IP, 10:20. Bombs away, 10:25. This helped Skippy keep track on where they were going to be in relation to the mission. The mission was going to be another long one, with the formation being in the air for over 7 hours, flying a grand total of 900 miles. In the waste compartment, Mills and Beans both stared out of their gunner's openings at the beautiful world that was below them. From where Beans was standing, looking out of the group's 5 o'clock position, Beans watched as the infamous White Cliffs of Dover were displayed off in the distance. The sight was simply breathtaking. In the tail, Pally was enjoying the beautiful view as well. The skies were clear where they were flying, but off in the distance of about 5 miles, dark, thick storm clouds hung just off the Great Yarmouth coast. Pally looked at the English coastline with such amazement. Both times he had crossed over the channel, he looked forward to this moment every single time. If it weren't for the constant dangers and thoughts of being killed each day, he'd say that the view was completely worth the time he invested into serving his country. Willie was in his top turret when he saw a ball turret from both planes in the high squadron all turn in the same direction, which was just to their 9 o'clock. When Willie aligned his turret in the same direction, he discovered what everyone was looking at. Off in the distance was a group of unidentified specks. Willie called them in, and soon, everyone on the plane had their guns aimed at the 9 o'clock position, ready for whatever was going to come their way. Within the next 5 minutes, the specks turned into two squadrons of Fokker Wolf 190s. The planes headed towards the formation, and soon the escort fighters went after them. As they did, the crew then heard a call come through that wrecked each man.
We got one of nines coming in, 11 o'clock low.
The call was from Andy, who just happened to be looking downward when he saw the specks. Tommy swung his turret towards the new incoming fighters, knowing that they didn't have any escort friendly stopping them from attacking. As he did, Tommy saw that the 109s were getting a lot closer than the 190s, and he felt that he needed to start sending bullets in the fighters' direction. However, he didn't. He knew that they were still too far away. For the next few seconds, Tommy held his thumbs on his trigger button, waiting for the moment to strike. His heart raced, his muscles tightened, and his breathing became more and more quick. Then, he began to fire. The 109 then zipped past Loder Bull and went on to attack a B-17 flying the 529th, which was flying the high squadron. Then another 109 banged to his right and let off some shots which were set in the direction of a B-17 flying the lead squadron, the 531st. The bullets ripped into the bomber's waste compartment area, and soon, both waste gunners stopped firing their guns, meaning that they were either too injured to fight, or they were both dead. After the 109 let off another stream of bullets, It banked to the right and began heading towards the group flying behind them.
"109 heading behind, 7 o'clock low,"
Tommy quickly yelled.
"I've got 109 coming in, hard and fast, 7 o'clock level,"
Mills yelled into the intercom.
"I see him,"
Willie said, as he had his sights on a 190 that had just banked upward and was attempting to escape the bomber's return fire. But, as Willie was getting ready to fire his guns, the 190 burst into flames and soon, it flipped upside down and was sent down towards Earth.
"B-17 falling behind, 6 o'clock low in the last group,"
Pally said, referring to seeing a B-17 flying off the back of Group 6, beginning to trail smoke and go into a deadly dive.
"Are they falling behind or are they just going down?"
the boss asked.
"Does it matter? 190, 5 o'clock low,"
Pally responded.
"Excuse me, Sergeant. It does matter, and remember who you're talking to,"
the boss called over. Jack thought the comment was unnecessary and thought that the boss was being a bit too harsh, but didn't say anything, for he was too overwhelmed by the calls coming in over the intercom. The first one he heard was from Willie, who said,
"We got 190s coming down, 4 o'clock high. Watch it, Beans,"
which was soon accompanied by Beans calling in.
"Well, I see him. Come on, you son of a biscuit."
And then distant gunfire.
109 coming through the 100th, 6 o'clock low. See him, Tommy?"
Pally asked.
"I see him. Trying to be sneaky, I see,"
Tommy said, just as he went to fire his guns on the lonely 109, which was attempting to attack a B-17 flying the 100th bombardment. Tommy watched as the 109 took two hits to its left wing and fuselage, and when it did, the plane began to trail smoke, oil, and gasoline. As the 109 was hit, the pilot banked his plane upward and attempted to try to bail out. However, the pilot didn't realize that he was heading towards Group 1 way too fast. The pilot simply didn't have enough time to exit his plane before it cut right through a B-17 flying the lead group's right wing, and the plane was flying the low number 6 spot of the lead squadron of the lead group. The clipped B-17 banked to the right and was sent downward with only 3 men able to escape a stricken bomber. Rosie, in the corner of his eye, watched the B-17 fall and watched for any additional chutes, but gave up when he saw the fortress crash into the English Channel. Because both Jack and the boss saw this event unfold, the boss called in the savagery, and Rosie added,
"I saw 3 chutes, Skippy."
Skippy left his gun and added the note to his notebook, and then returned to his guns and soon began firing on a 109 coming in. For the next several minutes, the intercom was full of activity.
109 heading in, 5 o'clock, Polly, watch it. I see him. Shit. Are you okay? Yeah, thanks, Tommy. No problem. 190's 9 o'clock high. Do you see him, Beans? Oh, jeez, I see him. You got C-109's heading in 11 o'clock level. Rosie, make sure you have your sights on him. Good morning, boss. 109 banking to the left side, 6 o'clock high. Oh, shit, I see him. Come on, Helmut. Let me send you to your maker.
To Jack, with every call, he waited for something to go wrong. Since he couldn't see the incoming attacks unless they passed by the front of the plane, he felt helpless and vulnerable. It was a feeling that ate him alive with each mission and each passing attack. 2 calls came in within a few seconds of each other that 2 109s were hit and going down, a small victory. However, that victory call was followed by a sorrowful,
"B-17 going down from the 94th, 6 o'clock high. I see them, I'll watch for shoots,"
Pally responded. For the next few minutes, the fighters aimed their attacks on groups 4, 5, and 6. Pally watched the carnage as a swarm of 190s jumped the bombers flying in group 6. Within a minute, they claimed one more heavy bomber before fleeing, with P-51 chasing behind them. The men from the Bull took deep breaths, realizing that they had survived one more fighter attack. 3 minutes later, Andy announced over the intercom that they had just reached their second waypoint, which was over the Dutch coast.
Do you love vintage warbirds? Do you love drinking good coffee? Would you love to be able to help keep warbirds in the sky by just drinking coffee every single morning? Well, believe it or not, you can by going to www.warbirdcoffeecompany.com and signing up for a bag of great tasting fresh roasted coffee. Guys, this is a veteran-owned and operated business that I discovered back in July. And let me tell you something, I drink so much of the stuff that you could say that Snafu runs off of Warbird Coffee Company. These guys partner up with operators and museums, and for every bag of coffee sold, they give back to their partners to help keep the memory of the Greatest Generation alive. They're available for everyone living in the United States and Great Britain. If you want to find out more about who they are and what they do, go to one of their social media pages by just searching up Warbird Coffee Company, and get this, if you use the promo code SNAFU20, again, SNAFU20, you will get 20% off any product that you buy from Warbirds, and if that's not enough, you can get 15% off your first order by visiting and subscribing to their website, www.warbirdcoffeecompany.com. Do you want to get more out of SNAFU? Well, guess what? There's good news for you because you can. You see, by becoming a supporter of the podcast, you will receive bonus content such as pictures and profiles of all the characters mentioned in today's episode, pictures and maps of the airfield and surrounding areas, as well as formation breakdowns of past, present, and future missions, and Q&A episodes. There is so much for you to gain by donating $3 or $10 to help support the podcast. If you would like to be a part of SNAFU each week, please visit our Patreon page. The link for that's down in the show notes. Any support goes a long way in helping the podcast to continue. In fact, to give a shout out to those who are supporting this podcast, we want to thank Fernando, Reinhold, Benita, Kyle, and Cedric. Thank you guys so much for all your support and your helping this podcast to continue. Your contribution is making a huge difference. Now, back to the podcast. It had been an hour and 15 minutes since the formation had been attacked by fighters, and over an hour since they had reached the Dutch coast. Now, the bombers had reached the decision point, which was 25 miles north of the town of Hamburg, Germany. The group had experienced light and distant flak, which wasn't totally harmless, for a few lucky shots had crippled B-17s flying in Group 2 and 3, but none of them fell away from the comfort and protection of the formation. In the nose, Andy looked out his navigator's window at the German countryside below him. He wondered why there weren't more fighters coming to attack him, but at the same time he wasn't complaining. Once the bombers all leveled off and headed towards their next waypoint, the IP, which was 50 miles northeast over the town of Bingen, they began to see flak ahead of the formation.
Flak level, clock low,
Rosie called in.
Flak jackets on now. Hold on, boys. It's going to get rough over the next 10 or 15 minutes,
Jack informed the men. Over the next 3 minutes, the flak became more accurate and more intense. Flak shells that were within 60 feet or so seemed to be going off at closer intervals as the bull made its way towards Frankfurt. In the nose, Rosie watched as the flak shell exploded just above Chief's right wing, punching holes all throughout its frame. Rosie kept watch for its engines to start slowing down or leaking fuel, oil, or smoke. But surprisingly, nothing happened.
Chief's right wing was peppered,
the boss called in.
I saw that too. I'll keep my eye on them,
Rosie replied. Another flak shell then exploded right in front of the bull's nose compartment. Before Rosie or Andy knew what was going on, dozens of holes appeared all along the left side of the nose, around, next to, and above the right side cheek gun. Three large holes were punched into the plexiglass window where the right cheek gun was placed.
Rosie, Andy, are you guys all right down there?
Asked the stunned and shaken up Jack.
We're all right, Jack,
Andy replied. Rosie looked up to his right at the amount of damage done to his station. And as he looked up, he saw there was a large hole cut into the top of the nose, right behind the nose cone. The hole was big enough that he could fit his fist through it. He then looked down and saw that in the floor, just behind him, was a hole about the same size punched into the wooden floor. When Rosie turned around and looked at Andy, he saw that Andy looked visibly shaken up, and his eyes were glued to the damage done to the front of the plane. Before Rosie could say anything else, the flak suddenly stopped. Willie in his top turret spoke up by asking,
Did it stop? I'm guessing so. I don't see any.
Beans responded.
Nothing down here,
Tommy replied.
That's odd,
Jack added. Over the next few minutes, the formation continued its path towards Frankfurt, and when they arrived over the town of Kreuznach, the flak began picking up again.
This time, the flak was accurate, intense. It seemed to be getting worse as the formation got closer. Tommy began calling in.
Flak 12, yeah, we know, we see it.
Mills fired back.
Jesus Christ!
Tommy's muffled voice rang into the intercom as two flak bursts went off on both sides of him. He could hear the shrapnel bouncing off the metal casing of his turret.
How far are we from hitting the goddamn IP?
Yelled out Jack.
2 more minutes,
Andy called in. Just as Andy finished his call, a flak shell went off right next to the bull's nose and left wing. Shrapnel tore into the bull's left side, next to Andy and under the cockpit. Andy saw sparks come from the number 2 engine, but nothing serious came from it. In the waste compartment, Mills held on for dear life as the plane bounced from side to side, like a bus driving over a rocky terrain. Beans fell to the ground after losing his footing, and Mills went to help him back up. As Mills lifted Beans off the empty bullet casing floor, another flak shell exploded under the bull, and before either of them knew what was going on, dozens of holes littered the floor of the waste compartment behind Mills' gunner station.
Everyone alright in the waste?
Tommy asked after seeing the flak shell go off and debris falling from the plane.
We're alright, the plane's getting shredded though.
Mills replied back.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Willie called in just before a flak shell went off just above his turret. The blast rattled Willie's turret, but as Willie observed the top of the bomber, he realized that nothing was damaged, thankfully. Then the men got the call that they had been waiting for.
Okay, men, we're at the IP. Your new heading is 0-9-3. Again, 0-9-3.
The call came in from Andy, who was just as excited as everyone else that they were getting closer and closer to making it through this barrage of flak. However, what Andy and everyone else knew in the back of their head was, the flak was only going to get worse before it got better. The formation made a slight right turn until Frankfurt was at their 11 o'clock position. Below them, off to their left, was the heavily defended German city of Mainz, which was responsible for most of the flak shells that the men of the 300th had experienced in the last 5 minutes. Rosie then called in over the intercom that he was opening the bomb bay doors and announced that the formation was on their bomb run. After doing so, he hunched over his bomb sight and looked down to see if he could identify the target. The target was at the southern edge of the city, across the river from Florsheim, a subsection of Frankfurt. Based off the aerial photographs that Rosie had seen earlier in the briefing, the complex was impressive with one large warehouse building on the top edge of the picture, or on the complex's eastern side. The aiming point, as he was told, was the center of the complex, where two long rows of small buildings were located. The men were also told that this complex helps to manufacture parts for vehicles, planes, trains, and military vehicles. Knocking out this complex would definitely put a dent in the local area's industrial infrastructure, as well as have lasting effects on the German war effort. What raised the stakes higher for men like Rosie was that if the bombs missed their mark, the facility was surrounded by residential housing for the impoverished lower class, which most of them worked at the complex, or worked at complexes in the area. Beans, in the waste compartment, was looking out through his gunner's opening and watched as flak shells made a direct hit in a bomb bay of a B-17 flying the high squadron of the group. The shell detonated the 8 1,000-pound general-purpose demolition bombs stowed in its bomb bay, and Beans watched in horror as the plane was turned into a fireball, with debris flying through the air. The vertical stabilizer and rudder of a B-17 flying next to it was torn almost completely from the tail section. By some miracle, no other bombers were brought down by the explosion, but a handful of them were damaged badly from the debris.
B-17 from the factory and I took a direct hit,
Beans called in.
I saw that, poor bastards,
Willie replied after he saw the explosion happen in the corner of his eye. Mills, who was at his gunner station, noticed that Fenway's bomb doors were not opening.
Fenway's bomb doors are not opening. Damn, keep an eye on them, Mills. I'm sure that they'll have to do it manually, just like we did.
Jack called back.
I think that's actually what they're doing now,
Mills said as he tried to look closer at Fenway, which was flying the opposite side of Chief's. Just then, a flak shell went off next to Mills' gunner station. Beals fell to the floor after the blast sent shrapnel all over his station. His plexiglass window had several holes punched into it, and the metal plate that sat under his gunner's position had dents riddling all over it. Mills' lifeless body fell onto the floor, and Beans knew, based on how his body collapsed, that he was either dead or unconscious. Beans went over to Mills, shouting his name over and over and over again. Skimpy just so happened to catch a glimpse of the activity going on in the waste compartment, and called in over the intercom.
Mills got hit! Mills got hit! What?
Jack said, looking behind him.
Go!
The boss thundered to Jack. Jack then got up out of his seat, him again walking his way through the open bomb bay, and into the radio room, and finally, into the waste compartment. When Jack got there, Mills was coming to his senses. That's when Jack saw Mills' flak vest was peppered with dents and pieces of shrapnel sticking out of the metal-plated vest, two of which were in Mills' abdominal area. Unfortunately, though, Mills' right thigh was covered in blood from a small flak fragment that made its way through the thick metal plating and punctured through Mills' multiple layers of clothing and into his thigh, just below the groin. Jack and Beans inspected the wound. The entire time, Mills was yelling over the loud sounds of engines and now wind rushing through every opening, asking if he was okay and what happened. As Jack and Beans attended to Mills, calls came in that two B-17s from Groups 2 and 3 were going down from sustaining too much flak damage. Then, Rosie called in over the intercom.
Bombs away!
And Skimpy, who was taking peeks back to the waste compartment, saw the bombs fall from the bomb bay and was glad to see none of them got stuck. Up in the cockpit, the boss turned the bull on his new heading, along with the rest of the formation, by turning slightly left and over the city of Frankfurt. As he did, the flak became even more intense and more accurate. One shell after another went off in front of the bull. Then, the boss watched as a flak shell went off under Chief's left wing, turning his number one and two engines into a roaring trail of fire. The boss watched as Captain Robert Dearborn, the 530th Squadron Commander, and the rest of his crew in their final moments.
Chief's hit. Fire broke out.
The boss said in shock at what he was seeing.
I see. I'll keep an eye out for shoots.
Rosie said back. It was clear that the left-side gas tanks were ignited, and that they were moments away from exploding. The plane banked to the left, which passed underneath Fenway, missing them by less than 15 feet. And once they were away from the formation, Captain Dearborn's crew began exiting and bailing out of the burning plane.
I see wastegunners bailing out.
Andy called in.
Someone just dropped from the bomb bay.
Rosie noted. Shortly after Rosie's comment, Chief rolled over, and in an instant, the entire left wing separated from the fuselage, and the burning left wing ignited the other remaining fuel tanks once it was more than 20 feet away from the stricken bomber. At the same time, Wildy was in his top turret and witnessed the flak shell explode under a B-17 flying the 531st Squadron, the lead squadron. The B-17 had already taken so much damage from previous flak that the large blast, along with its thousands of metal pieces of shrapnel, tore the bomber to bits. Soon, pieces of the plane's nose, underbelly, and other sections fell away from the bomber. One of the pieces was that of an airman from the front of the plane. The man's lifeless body dropped from the sky.
B-17 from the 531st falling apart and behind.
Willie called in somberly.
Oh, come on, another one?
Said Pally, who was so terrified in the tail that his hands were shaking when he engaged his microphone cord.
I see him. Jesus.
Tommy said as the weakened fortress fell away from the formation and came into his view. When he looked, the B-17's nose was busted open to the point of Tommy was able to see the inside of the nose compartment from the outside. The entire left side was missing. Along with that, the bomber's number two engine was spitting out flames from the propeller that was losing control and spinning violently. In the waste compartment, Jack and Beans had successfully gotten Mills situated. His thigh wound was worse than they thought, and he was losing a ton of blood. Mills was sitting up against the side of the waste compartment, next to his gunner's position. Jack then quickly got back into the cockpit, where he was stunned to see that Chief was gone, and the B-17 from the 531st flying the number 3 spot was also gone. In the radio room, Skibby had gone back to his radio desk and was checking the radio frequency,
because to him, the liaison signal sounded muffled and garbled, more than normal. Little did he realize that below the plane, the vertical antenna, which sat under the waste compartment, had been damaged from the flak burst earlier. As Skippy tried to check the frequency, a flak shell exploded on the left side of the bowl and caused the entire plane to shift to the right. The blast had caused Skippy to close his eyes, and when he opened them back up, all he saw was black.
Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you because you can. You see, by visiting our website, www.snafupod.net, you can find all kinds of amazing free, it's important, free resources to help you find out more about the 8th Air Force in World War II and about the B-17 Flying Fortress. Right now, you can take a virtual tour of two real B-17s like the ones depicted in Snafu. Also, you can find links to movies, documentaries, and free YouTube videos, and much, much, much more. All you have to do is visit www.snafupod.net and check it out for yourself. Now, back to the podcast.
Skippy! Skippy!
Willie called over the sounds of roaring engines. Skippy moved his head in the direction of the voice but couldn't see anything. Thinking that he had been hit, he touched his face and nothing seemed to be bleeding or seemed to be hit. He then heard talking coming from a familiar voice, but due to the loudness of his surroundings, he couldn't tell who it was. It was the boss. The boss and Willie were checking Skippy out. Skippy's station had been hit by a flak shell, but luckily, Skippy was unhurt. His liaison receiving box was smoking after a flak fragment had busted it open. Above his station, holes littered the metal siding and ceiling. What confused Willie and the boss was that Skippy, even though he couldn't see, didn't seem to be affected by light or movement. Willie even attempted to slap Skippy, expecting him to flinch, but he didn't. The boss didn't have anything to add, so he leaned forward and said to Skippy,
Skippy, you're fine. I don't know what's going on. Just sit here and call if you need anything. Your black receiving box is damaged, okay?
Skippy nodded his head, feeling scared and crippled by his situation. Once the boss arrived back in the cockpit, Jack informed him that two more B-17s had been hit by flak. Before the boss could say anything further, that's when Andy called over the intercom.
We're at the rally point. New heading is 304. Again, your new heading is 304.
As soon as the boss began turning the plane, he heard a call come over the intercom that cut him deeply.
We lost Bombshell Blondie.
The voice was from Pally, who watched the flak shell tear right through Michael Shelby's left wing, completely separating the wing from the plane and causing their burning fortress to spiral viciously down towards Earth. The boss shuddered at the call, and so did Jack. Jack remembered having that conversation with Shelby a few nights previous, and now he was gone. Forever. The boss was shaken, and he couldn't believe it. He had cared for Shelby like he was a little brother to him, and he was attempting to get his awkward co-pilot acquainted with other men like Hill House in Texas. What bothered the boss more than anything was, not only could he not remember what Shelby's co-pilot's name was, but he couldn't even remember what he looked like. Over the next few minutes, the flak continued and claimed another victim from the back of the formation. But finally, after flying through 29 minutes of flak, the longest flak barrage the 300th had ever flown through, it was finally done. It had been 10 minutes since the flak stopped, and the boss was trying to enjoy the moment of peace and no one trying to kill him. That comfort was soon extinguished when Rosie called in over the intercom.
Boss, we've got bogies coming in 12 o'clock low.
The tone of Rosie's call was alarming to the boss, and it meant that they were getting close, too close for comfort.
Okay, suit up, boys. We've got no cover to our 12 o'clock and our 5 o'clock. We need to be...
The boss was interrupted by Rosie calling in.
Here they come!
Suddenly, Rosie's chin turret opened fire, and from where the boss was sitting, he couldn't see anything
until five squadrons of ME-109s zipped up through the formation and over the boss.
Jesus Christ!
Jack called in after seeing the swarm of yellow-painted 109s fly past his windshield. Willie, when he saw how many planes were up in the air above him, he wondered how they and their friendly escorts were ever going to make it back to England. At first glance, the Germans seemed to outnumber the friendlies, which had just arrived back 2-1.
I see him. I need help.
Willie called in.
I'm coming back.
Jack said, jumping out of his seat and heading to the radio room. Once in there, Jack grabbed a radio gun and began aiming it at the 109 zipping downward towards the formation. Pushing down on his trigger, he could feel the single 50-caliber gun thumping and recoiling in his hands. Jack let off a long line of fire in the direction of the incoming 109s until they disappeared behind the bull. Jack then felt the plane shudder, and it was then that he realized that he never plugged in his audio cord, so Jack plugged his in and called to see if anybody was hurt. Pally was the first one to respond.
I'm okay, I'm fine, but our left horizontal stabilizer shot up. Is your oxygen running fine?
Jack asked.
Yes, sir,
Pally responded. Jack then looked down at Skimpy and saw that Skimpy was slightly shaking and was crying. But just as Jack was going to tend to him, Willie called in.
Jack, we've got 2 190s coming in 4 o'clock high.
Jack swung his gun over as far as he could, and soon, Beans, Willie, and Jack were firing upon the two planes that were heading to attack both the bull and the Federal bombshell. Bullets ripped into the bull's horizontal stabilizer, punching 3 large holes towards the top, and then, just as more bullets were about to be sent in the bull's direction, one of the gunners from Fenway Bombshell scored a lucky shot, turning one of the 109s into a dead stick, plummeting towards Earth. The other 109 flipped upside down and dove away, unharmed.
I've got another 109 coming up, 7 o'clock level,
Polly called in. Beans in the waste compartment quickly left his gun, went over to Mills, and began firing from it, with Mills passed out underneath him. The 109 screamed through the formation, and banged hard to his right, and passed over the bull, missing his tail by less than 8 feet. Jack quickly saw the fighter move past his position, with the 109's propellers missing him by less than 8 feet. It was so quick and fast that Jack didn't have enough time to react. Shocking was, within seconds, a P-51 followed behind, chasing the German plane. In the nose, Rosie was firing his chin turret at a 109 flying in front of the formation. None of his tracers came close, and soon, it got within range for Andy to use his left sight cheek gun, and he too began firing on the 109. None of his bullets made contact.
109 coming down, 11 o'clock,
Rosie called in.
We've got 109s coming in, 6 o'clock low,
Pally called in. Tommy, who was in his ball turret still, aimed his guns at the 3 109s that Pally was calling in, and soon he aimed his guns and began firing. All 3 109s maneuvered themselves around the gunfire, and one by one, they made their attacks and quickly dove away. Neither Pally or Tommy were able to land any hits. Within 3 minutes, the fighters began leaving with the P-51s chasing them away. Amidst the chaos, 3 more B-17s were unfortunately shot down. One of them produced no parachutes. Once the men saw that the fighters were leaving, Jack returned back to the cockpit, and once he got there, he could see that the boss was nervous and scared, but still keeping it together. Jack offered to take the controls, which he did, and he was the one who took the men home. Within the next minute, the formation had arrived at their 4th waypoint, and were more than halfway home. An hour and 45 minutes later, the 300th arrived over Thurlow. Out of the 21 planes the 300th had sent up just 8 hours earlier, only 17 returned. One of the first planes to land was the Bull, which landed on the eastern end of Runway 3 and rolled off into the grass. Paramedics arrived at the Bull, and when they did, Willie, Beans, Pally, and Tommy helped to get Mills out of the plane. Mills was so weak from the blood loss that when he asked for a smoke, Willie had to hold the cigarette for him since he couldn't move his arm, let alone hold a cigarette. Once they loaded Mills into a stretcher and put him in the back of the ambulance, they went in for Skimpy, but the medics were unsure as to why he was labeled injured when he wasn't physically hurt. But once they realized that Skimpy had no eyesight, they then helped him exit the plane and brought him back to the hospital. Within the next few minutes, Bomb McGee would land, and it was revealed that they had lost both their waste gunners during the last fighter attack, and they also lost their radio operator to Flak. Hellfire from above returned with bullet holes all over the nose cone, tail, and right wing. Their outer gas tank was hit, but luckily, the fuel inside was for the most part used up. Flak holes also littered all over the underside of the bomb bay, waste compartment, and tail section. However, nobody was injured. Fenway would be the last one to land since, by some miracle, they made it through the entire ordeal without getting a single scratch, dent, flak hole, or bullet hole. The one that tore the men up more than anyone else was the fate of Georgia Bell. Georgia Bell, the cursed bomber, which had a rookie pilot and rookie co-pilot flying it today, returned shot up and damaged. The rookie pilot was struggling with landing the B-17 due to the fact that he had lost so much airspeed on ascending that the moment he realized that he needed more airspeed, it was entirely too late. The B-17 slammed into the English countryside, just short of runway 3. There were no survivors. It was revealed later that the pilot was injured and the co-pilot was close to dying, and the pilot's failure to make a successful landing was due to the fact that he had lost so much blood he wasn't able to critically think through the landing. Overall, the 300th had lost a total of 5 planes. 50 men were missing, killed, or captured by the Germans. On top of that, 9 more men would return to Thurlow dead. 2 would die within the next 24 hours, 9 men returned injured, and 7 of them would be sent home with Purple Hearts. Of the now 5 planes lost in the 300th, 2 of them were piloted by close friends of the boss. Michael Shelby and the 530th Squadron Commander, Captain Robert Dearborn, the man that sang the boss's praises to Colonel Poole, were now gone. The boss, Rosie, and Jack returned to the officers' club after the debriefing was over with, and immediately began drinking. Jack was so tired and fed up with the day's events that he simply didn't give a damn, a point that he never thought he'd get to. The biggest gun punch of the boss was, later he would learn that every single bomb dropped on the complex in Frankfurt missed the target, and men like Michael Shelby, Robert Dearborn, and the boys from Georgia Bell ultimately died that day, just to level a housing development, in where over 140-some German families were forever wiped off the face of the planet, labeling this mission a complete failure. Thank you for listening to Episode 16 of Snafu, a historical fiction podcast depicting the average life of a bomber crew in World War II. If you would like more information about the podcast, please visit our website and our Patreon page. Both links are down in the show notes. This podcast is produced by Canso 34 Studios, a DIY project helping to raise awareness to the brave young men who sacrificed their lives in the skies over Europe in World War II. I hope you do it justice. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned next week for episode 17 of Snafu.